Bandwidth and hosting for Bagel Tech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Web hosting for everyone. The Photography Podcast for the photographer in you. This is Bagel Tech Photo, episode number 25 for Monday, February 21st, 2011. The Numbers Game. Hey everybody, welcome to another week, another installment of Bagel Tech Photo. We've got kind of a MTV Unplugged edition today, shall we say. It's just going to be me and the other stalwart on the network, Mr. Ewan Rankin.
Hello,
how
mate.
Are you?
I'm all right, mate. You?
I'm good. It's been an up and down week. I'm Mac-less right now, so
your
I'm
Mac
sad.
Died, I heard. You're not allowed on the Mac show, you know, mate, unless you've got an active working Mac.
I've got an iPhone as a count.
Yeah, that'll do. Because otherwise we're too short today.
Now the thing crapped out, but I found a motherboard for it. So I'm actually going to be able to probably get that fixed on Monday. So I'm happy about that.
Jolly good.
Yeah, really, really happy. How's your week been? What you been up to?
It's been all right. It's been okay. I've had a good week. I've got the video sorted, I think. So fingers crossed. Apart from the little glitch before we started, and it's been all right. I've been pretty busy. I've done a fair bit of stuff. So and we've lost Kyle and we've lost Alex and Chris. With both of them to work. So there you go. Everybody's working except me today and you.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes me feel real good going into the show now. Thanks.
Oh, yes. It'll be fine. Don't worry.
I can
carry it, love.
We'll just have a nice little laid-back edition.
Leisurely, exactly.
Yes. I had seen this one thing about the NEC using active noise cancellation for quieter zooming. Now, this is definitely not pro-grade camera, but I was more intrigued by why do we need active noise cancellation? Would this be more because of video than for photos, or educate me here, man.
Well, excuse me. No, the active noise cancellation thing is to stop the motor sounds when it zooms. So I'm guessing what you're going to see here is now the one thing that you've got with video cameras or stills cameras that have video associated with them is that you very often lack the ability to focus during the shot. So once you've picked your focus, that's it. And it tries to shoot with as big a depth of the field as possible. And you also then get the problem of the fact that you don't get to zoom in and out and change your focal length on the picture you want to take. So if they're getting to that point where they can allow you to change your focal length during the shot and change your autofocus, thumbs up, absolutely thumbs up. But with that comes the price, I suppose, which is the cost of the noise of the motor. And because the microphones are so close to these things and they're picking up, you know, enormous range. I mean, you'd know about microphones. These are little tiny, tiny active microphones that will pick up an ant farting at 20 yards. They're going to pick up the motor on the camera. So if it's trying to do it deliberately and get rid of that noise sensor, the noise of the motors, I don't see a problem with it. I think it's a great idea.
No, I think it's a really good idea too. That's why I was saying that it's definitely more aimed towards the shooting video side with the camera and has nothing to do with the actual taking pictures.
Yeah, well, the other thing it might be doing as well is looking to get rid of that kind of ambient sound. You know, when you're in kind of like an urban area, you've got that ambient traffic rush that's going on in the background. If it's dealing with that as well as, that would be really cool because that's the one thing that really makes your audio unusable on video cameras. But if that was the case, I don't see why they wouldn't have done that in a proper video camera rather than doing it on a stills camera that's shooting video.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking too. I mean, maybe it's just because this is, like I said, this is not nowhere near the pro line here. This is definitely consumer grade all the way. And you see a lot more, particularly on YouTube, people are shooting video with their, you know, with their cameras nowadays. And it is a bit annoying. I've been up that road where you're sitting there, you can actually hear that motor cranking in the camera when you're trying to zoom in on something. And it is very loud.
It is loud. It's really loud. But, I mean, anything that improves the standard quality of your video and your audio has got to be a good thing. Just watch out because a lot of these things, you know, as with photography, you know, you sharpen an image to get it back. If you've got slightly blurred or slightly out of focus, you can improve it just a fraction with sharpening. But there's a price you pay with that, which is noise on the image. With this, if you're talking about noise cancellation of the motion parts and the other things around the ambient sounds, there's a chance you might actually lose a sound that you wanted in the video as well. So, you know, have a play. I mean, it's got. I think it's got to be a good thing. And if you've got the ability to switch it on or off in the software, I think that's even better.
Yeah, I think that's actually the very much the plus on it too. Mm. That way, like you said, if you do want to capture those minute sounds that you think you're losing in another, you do have a way of at least trying to achieve that. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool. I was just thinking, noise cancellation for photos just doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense.
No.
On to the next thing now here, and this is Samsung is developing a 12 megapixel BSI CMOS sensor for camera phones. Now we're talking about consumers using cameras now. Most everybody has got a camera on their phone now, and a lot of people are taking pictures with their cameras.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was really, really good this week was the NVIDIA chipset that came out for tablets.
Yes, I did see that, yeah.
That's a quad-core processor. Well, that's a quad-core chip, rather, for handling graphics and so on. And also Qualcomm came out with a new processor as well, which is going to handle up to 20 megapixels. So in terms of data volume, we're really starting to see chips that are being able to handle very much more volume of information and detail. Whether the sensors are going to provide that in adequate quantity and clarity and quality is a different question. If any of the things that are advances forward, great, I'm 100% behind them. But you've got to use them, and you've got to find out whether the claim is just an increase in numbers, or whether it's just as a marketing ploy, or whether it actually is a big improvement and a big boon going forwards of what the camera can do to you.
Well, the saying here is like a 1.12 backside illuminated pixel architecture for high quality imaging on premium feature, or is a premium feature on smartphones. So I guess they're trying to achieve a bigger number than that. I'm trying to actually read the actual numbers here and get what you're talking about. Is it just a numbers game, or actually increasing that sensor size on the phone?
Well, a micron's a thousandth, I think, thousandths of a millimeter. So they're saying that each of the pixels is 1/1000th of a millimeter, which is pretty tiny.
Tiny, yeah.
Yeah. Now, how big they actually go? I mean, we were saying last week, there was one at 1,000 pixels across. So that's really, really tiny. And I can't see the quality of this being that huge. I mean, it's only shooting video at 720p, so that's not good either. There was an interesting article this week on Ars Technica. I was just trying to find it while you were talking there. And it's about how the human brain engages with numbers. And it goes back to what we've always been saying about not looking at the right volume increase, as in with sensors, as in the physical size of them, and only going for the megapixel each. And it's saying that people who get monthly plans that say 31 days on them, so pay now and get for the next 31 days, will always take the 31-day plan over the 30-day plan, not realizing that over the course of the year, you're only going to get 28 days in February. Right. And it's saying that people tend to be attracted to the higher number. It's on Ars Technica, ArsTechnica.com. And I'll stick it in the show notes, but it's a really good article about why people get obsessed with the sheer numbers that are on marketing and branding and will only buy based on those without understanding the quality and the other issues associated with how those numbers are achieved. So if you look at things like the Quattron TVs, they're saying that they're scanning across four color bases. Well, there is only three color bases, red, green and blue. That's it. They're saying that they've got yellow. No, you're not. Actually, what you're doing is screwing around with the green and the blue.
But, oh, right. You know, yeah.
People buy because there's four, quat, as opposed to try. There you go. Quad.
Well, it is a numbers game. But we're saying by numbers game, though, here, is there a way of, I don't know how to actually put this, is it a software thing where you can have the same size of sensor that's in the iPhone 4 right now, and with a piece of software actually enhance that sensor to achieve more light to come in, or is it purely a hardware thing?
No, because I mean, at some point the hardware is going to have to improve significantly, or the software is going to have to help it improve. So I don't say that software can't help it improve, but what I'm saying is, as we stand at the moment, there are real issues of getting very small sensors to produce high enough quality images. Now, at 12 megapixels in a phone, I would have said that you're starting to look pretty ropey if you're printing it out for your wall or something like that. You'd start to look pretty ropey above 7x5. If you're talking about 5 megapixels, that kind of stuff with a better quality sensor like the iPhone can be when it's got good daylight, then you'd probably manage 7x5 quite comfortably. So it's all about your output size, and it's all about capturing the moment. We keep saying it. You know, you pull your camera out, you take a picture, you get a decent picture worth using. Well, don't be fooled by 12 megapixels being a better picture than 10 megapixels. You have to physically go and take a picture with the item and have a look at what it produces for you. And if it produces crap, then it's going to produce crap no matter what you do. And watch out for light levels with cell phones as well, because if the light level goes down, they get very, very kludgy, very, very rapidly. The iPhone is a piece of dirt when it's got very little or very poor light. But then that's what cameras are supposed to be, you know?
Exactly. It's all about getting the light. Exactly.
Yeah.
I completely contested that. If you're shooting at night in a nightclub, these kind of places, forget it. Mm. You're not going to get an image to save your life. But if you're on a bright, sunny day, I mean, the first day that I took my iPhone 4 out and really got to really test it was New Year's Day. It was a beautiful day here. Big
great
blue
pictures.
Sky, sun was out. Yeah, and it took some really stunning pictures. I was really impressed with it. But, it's funny because we're talking about, dealing with, what consumers are wanting, the bigger picture, the more the megapixel, the better. Well, apparently 90% of camera users are actually sharing their images online. I found this kind of intriguing, actually. I would assume most is probably going to places like Flickr, the free services and things. We've talked about Flickr in the past on the show, about do pros really use it? I think you've used it occasionally, but nothing as a resale type of thing.
No, definitely not.
And Facebook, I think, is probably also having a poke at this too. I mean, you're just seeing loads and loads of picture data going up on Facebook. Are we getting to a point now where we're seeing 90% of these things, people sharing their images online? Are we getting to a point now where are we going to have to worry about that the numbers game doesn't matter anymore? People aren't going to care about quality anymore? Because let's face it, when they get up online, they get compressed considerably.
You say that, but with Flickr, you can put full res images on. There's absolutely nothing stopping you putting the full 18 megapixel image up there at 20 megabytes, and if you've got an unreserved account, it's fine. And the full res picture goes up there. It's not compressed for anything other than the thumbnail. And likewise, you can download it. If you give access to it, you can download it at full resolution. I think the thing that people are going to care about quality, because the people that want to use those images for the purposes of advertising work or for display will care very highly about them, because it's important to reproduce accurately and it's important to reproduce a good quality image. I think there'll always be a place for the professional, but that professional's being crimped by the professional like amateur, the person who's got a good deal of talent that they've only used as a hobby and has come forward and now decided they want to make a few bucks out of it. I think the people that go down a nightclub and shoot willy-nilly and then just throw it up on any of the Creative Commons places, they'll shoot the odd thing that someone think, oh, I can crop that, but generally speaking, once you grow those things up to 100%, then you'll find that they'll start to fall apart pretty quickly.
And that's kind of what I thought I'd actually hear from you. That the pros are always going to care. That's a given. I'm just wondering if we're getting into a time now where people are so used to just seeing an image on a screen that they don't care about the full resolution that is anymore. I mean, similar to like MP3s versus, CD audio quality. Well, I can't tell the difference, but there is a difference. And again, it's only the pros that really notice that.
I think the thing you've got to watch for is the cataloging of online content has got to get better. So in terms of things like categories, if you give people categories to choose from in which their photos fall, the problem you'll have is people ticking every category because they want to be found in as many places as possible. You then start to need to be more selective about how you categorize your photo. You can have categories, you can only have two categories, or you can have one major category, one subcategory. You look at iPhone games in the App Store, there's more than three or four of the applications that I've looked at just this week alone pop up in five different categories within the App Store. for applications. That's not good, because what it means is everything's everywhere. Well, at that point, you then can't start to filter it through. There's no Dewey Decimal System, or there's no the cataloging system.
It's oversaturation. It's
not oversaturated, because the same unit values are out there. It's just you can't find a frigging thing. And that's what's got to be careful. That's what places like Flickr have got to be careful of. You know, don't let people just cut and paste a dictionary into the keywords and accept it. They have to choose categories that they fall into and keep it very, very selective. You know, this is only one category with one subcategory, or this is only two categories with one subcategory each. You know, that kind of thing needs to come in, because at the moment it's a bit of a wild west. It's definitely a bit of a free for all, and that's not good.
If we could get something like that, it would definitely not only benefit, you know, the consumers are the ones that want to be a pro for a day, and it would also benefit the pros tremendously as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I want my stuff to be found, so I want it to be found for what it's useful for.
Exactly. That's the point of tags, for God's sakes.
But that's the point, is that the pro wants their stuff to be found for what it's useful for, so they'll keyword it very carefully, whereas the amateur won't. They'll keyword it so that they think they're going to get mass exposure, not realizing it works against them. But then the problem is, what they're doing is they're increasing the size of the crap pool in the process as well. As I've got no issue with amateurs posting photography and making money from it. There's plenty of room for all of us.
Agreed, yeah. And why be worried? Because again, the word says it all. Amateurs.
If you can take a picture,
you can take a picture. Right. And you hope one day that by seeing that or by doing that, they get more of a love for it, and they want to turn pro. I mean, ultimately, in the end, you have to start somewhere. So,
yeah, I think you've got to look at it as like, you know, you cast your mind back to the French Revolution or that kind of era there. You know, the other bloke opposite, you may not have a perfect fencing technique, but when he cuts your right arm off, you know, who cares?
What a hell of an analogy.
Works.
It works, so yeah. Yeah, we always talk about on this show, Ewan, about tricks, little things, cheap ways of doing things. But there's always going to be people out there that want to go out and spend the money. And you know, when I see things like this, I don't know why. Gary Fong, I believe is how it is, it has unveiled a new Lightsphere value pack. I guess it's a whole set here. I actually seen this over the photography blog. It's at photographyblog.com. It looks like I'm about to put a flashlight together. And it's $120 to do it.
Yeah.
What exactly do I use this for?
It's collapsible product bundle. I can't even see, really. It's a white dome, an amber dome, a chrome dome, and a gel kit. Oh, right, okay. So this is something that's going to go on your camera, and it's going to give you lighting effects, I would guess. I should have read this really first, shouldn't I? Chrome-plated snoot.
Yeah, but it's okay.
Now, a snoot is a lighting attachment that if you've got a reflector spreads the light, because it allows all the light that's gone back into the flash to then be pushed back out forwards again, so it intensifies it and gives you the maximum value of the lamp. A snoot is trying to give you a shaft of light, so it brings everything down and inwards and points it at specific areas. And you'll use snoots and things like that for lighting hair or coming from behind an image where you don't want to affect the metering of the total image. You just want to highlight things that are standing up. Hairs is a great example of where it's used the most. This thing is a little tiny gel kit that looks like it can do really quite an awful lot. And it just fits over your flash, so you get coloured flash, you'll get intensified flash, you'll get subdued flash, and you'll get directional flash. I think it's a great idea.
Okay, so I was sitting here dogging the thing, and then actually it is not a bad idea.
Well, it's $119. $120. Yeah, $120. The Pro Kit's $169.
$170,
yeah. Yeah, but I mean, this is, again, I keep coming back to the cheap solution. Right. If you've got a decent flash gun, spend your money, buy decent kit that's going to last you. So get yourself a decent body, get yourself decent lenses, get yourself a decent flash gun. When you've got that decent flash gun, there's an awful lot of things that you can do with it. There's sweet paper wrappers, as I said before. You know, there's a fantastic infinite supply of coloured gels. And when you've finished using them, you throw them in a waste paper bin and get another one out. And, you know, you can keep going. There's tons of stuff out there that you can use if you just get creative. And I think that's the whole point, is that photography is a creative art. So the ability to save yourself money leads to the creativity. It's a self-sustaining thing.
And you know, this is coming from you, a pro. I mean, don't you think these things are kind of more directed towards somebody like me that thinks, oh yeah, I want to get into this, and I'm going to be all pro about it. I'm going to get what the pros use. But in actual fact, at the end of the day, the pros don't use a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, no, I remember playing golf. I mean, I was in me day, I was a decent enough golfer, had a good handicap. And I remember playing with a guy once, getting paired up with him at a bit of a snooty club, and he got all Callaway equipment, Callaway bag, Callaway shoes, FootJoys. He got branded golf gear, Callaway and that kind of stuff, Callaway umbrella. And I pinged me drive down the corner with my little scratch sack on, and he promptly stood up and shanked his into the trees. So, I mean, it's... I think the amateur does suffer a little bit from all the gear, no idea.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, it to me, when I see, you know, because if there is a way to take a piece of little cellophane paper and get the same effect for something I can pay $120 for, I want to listen to the pro on that.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Dicker probably have a better take on this than me being a lecturer, but I mean, he clearly is teaching kids, you know, the elements of photography at the very base level. But the one thing that Chris, Alex, and I have all got in common is that we had no frigging money when we started doing it, because we used to have to use, you know, we were always in the dark room, so you had your chemicals, you had the film itself, you had the paper to buy, or you used labs to do it for you, which were expensive, very expensive at times, and you didn't have the money left over to spend it on anything else that was over and above that. So we always bought decent camera bodies, we always bought decent lenses, we always bought decent flash units, we always bought a decent light meter. And then everything else from there was created using innovation rather than created using money. And it was only the high end stuff, you know, the bigger photographers that made a lot of money that used it. And like I said, you know, that Chris was saying the other week, he's running around at a function and he realizes his flash is blowing someone out, so he takes a napkin and stretches it over his flash unit to try and dim them down. I'm using scotch tape to try and dim mine down with tissue paper. You know, that kind of stuff is stuff that's come out of many, many years of being bloody broke, nothing else.
Well, I think that sometimes leads to the best creativity.
Yeah,
you know, when you're on a budget, It's you learn to use things around you, and a lot of times, that just stays with you. That's what you use all your life. That's where you learn from, and you see it. It's, you know, my only thing that I can compare it to is a struggling musician. They don't have the best equipment from the beginning. You know, yeah, sure, they improve. They add some stuff later on.
Yeah.
But you always go back to the fundamentals of why you do it. It's not about what little toy you have in the closet.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're struggling for a pot filter. You go and get a pair of your mom's old tights. I don't know, what's tights
exactly.
What's tights in American?
Hosiery? Would it be pantyhose?
Pantyhose. You go and get your mom's pantyhose and make yourself a pop screen.
Exactly. No, that's what I love about it. And you can do it as long as it's art. You know, you can do it in any art. Painting, you can do it in photography. You can do it in music.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I think it makes you. It makes you work harder for it.
There's a certain element as well. I'm pretty lazy. You know, I use Photoshop for putting Gaussian blurs on and things like that, or for making halo effects around things. And I can go back to the days where I used to have to smear Vaseline on the lens. And to a certain degree, it was a better effect. It looked more natural. It was less uniform. It had a certain randomity about it. So you know, maybe I'm not doing myself any favours by living off me prowess, if you like.
Shall we do some questions?
Let's.
We've got three of them this week.
Good questions this week.
Yeah, I was looking through them, and they are good questions. We're going to start with David, and he's saying, "Hi, guys, love the show. I have a question about autofocus modes. I often shoot racing yachts as a hobby. That's a nice hobby. And wondered what the panel thought about shooting with continuous AF. I guess that means autofocus, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Or single AF. By the way, it's nice to finally have a podcast which doesn't keep fawning over the latest gadgets like we all have 1,000 pounds to spend." I appreciate that, David. Loving the tips like envelopes and reflectors and tissue paper and napkins. We were just talking about that on flash units. He's actually suggesting this, you, and he says, why not have a feature on other like on the other shows? I guess he's pertaining to the Mac and our big show. That we have things that have low cost tips from the pros. So
yeah,
instead of like
cool
thingies
idea.
Or eye thingies, something like that. It's a good idea.
Yeah, he suggested the cheap thingy.
So the cheap thingy.
We're going to do that. We're all going to pick a cheap thingy each week. There you go.
We'll start next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, question. Autofocus mode.
Yes, and racing yachts.
Now, I do a fair bit of sports photography, so stuff's moving reasonably quickly. Racing yachts are going to get well up there. They're going to be 30, 40 miles an hour plus, potentially. I would never use continuous autofocus.
And why?
What you're doing is you're expecting to focus on something, and then the camera is constantly adjusting itself. And also, as well, I never use ambient metering modes and things like that. I always go for a spot focus and spot metering. So then I'm always shooting effectively in manual. So I look at what I want to shoot. I press, I shoot, because each time then the camera is grabbing it. Now, that only works really, really well when you've got a very good lens, and I'm fortunate that, you know, I've got a $3,000 lens that autofocuses extremely quickly, so that makes a huge difference. But continuous, I would say, should be used with caution. I'm not going to poo-poo it because it's got its time and its place. But if you've got a good lens, and a lot of the lenses now really are very good at shooting. I know David asked this question last week in the chat room after we'd finished, which is why we've included it this week. And he said he got the Sigma 70-300. Now, that hasn't got a fantastically fast autofocus on it, but, you know, generally speaking, for yachts and that kind of stuff, it'll do okay. And you've got to bear in mind as well that unless you're shooting something like a plane, which is really changing its focus very, very fast, you're probably going to get reasonably close with that. A boat coming towards you could be very difficult, but certainly panning across, the autofocus doesn't change fast enough for it to really make a difference.
Even with racing yachts, I mean, because, you know, we're not talking about the I'm out for a lovely Sunday afternoon on the lake. No, these are obviously enthusiasts.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a big swell on the sea, then that could be a little bit more destructive to your image. But then I think this is where you've got to buy the kit to suit your hobby. So, you know, I haven't got a cheap thingy for this. But if that's your thing, if that's what you like doing, David, then go out and spend the money on a decent lens that will fit your hobby. There's no point in shooting using a fantastically fast autofocus sports lens when you predominantly do landscapes. What's the point? Go and buy what you want to do. You know, you want a landscape, you want something that's high quality, doesn't have to have a fast response. Once, generally speaking, you'd look for a higher f-stop setting, so that'll bring your price down. Don't go for the lens that you buy in the shop. You know, think about what you're using it for, and if you've got a decent camera shop, some of them still exist, then ask for their advice on what the best kind of lens is for the hobby that you've got.
It makes a lot of sense, yeah. Pick the tools that you need to do the job right, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't mean you can't do the tools with other tools. But right, you know, yeah. There are certain obvious, you know, don't buy a pair of football boots if you want to play cricket. You know, there is that kind of element to it.
Our next question comes from Walter Evans in Denver, Colorado. It's nice to actually see some of our listeners stateside. And he's asking, what is the best way to get correct exposures for sunset shots? I usually shoot a 3 image exposure bracketing with a tripod, and my camera is set for a spot metering. Now, what I'm going to ask you a side question: what is spot metering, Ewan?
Spot metering is where when you look through the lens of your camera or through the viewfinder or on the back of the LED
screen.
Yeah, the LCD screen. What you'll see in there is a little dot in the middle, and spot metering saying that I'm going to work out the rest of the photo based on the light level that I see over this point. So if you point it at the sun, everything else is going to be dark. If you point it at the dark trees, everything else is going to be overexposed. And what he's trying to say there is, where should I point it, or should I look for more ambient metering, so get it to meter by region. A lot of the more expensive cameras, you can actually change the spot metering point so that it's off center as well. Mine does that, so you've got little autofocus and metering modes where you can move it around in the viewfinder to meter from different places and do that manually as you're taking the shot. Generally speaking, I'm not a great one for landscapes, like I said, so I'm not a great person to ask this question. Probably Alex would have a better answer. But I would say get yourself a gradient filter. That makes a huge difference. And I would get one that's just plain grey. Because then you've seen the classic image of the red sky, and it then graduates down to the horizon, and it's very 70s and 80s kind of looking. Don't get coloured filters, just get yourself a grey gradient filter, and then you'll have your core image and your core colours there, and you can start to slide it up and down on the camera to get the best effect that you can, just to maybe take some of the intensity out of the sun. Failing that, shoot yourself in RAW and have a play with the sliders when you get back into Photoshop. That could help you out. And also, he's talking there about taking a bracketed image, so I'm guessing he's probably doing a little bit of HDR on it. Just watch out for that, because as I say, there's some HDRs you can get really to the point where it looks grossly unnatural. But I would
completely
say that,
agree with that.
Yeah, no,
I've had that experience on the iPhone. I mean, you take that's particularly in a lot of light. I'd leave it off. It's just unnatural.
Yeah, no, well, so it's useful to have. If you're talking about shifting across the three images just by small amounts, then you actually will just genuinely enhance an image. You start taking some of them and they then become an image that even your eye wouldn't see in that kind of detail, and that's not very good. I don't like that. It's my personal viewpoint though.
Too much software input.
Yeah, I would say think carefully about where you meter on the image. Maybe think about taking a meter reading to one side, or even then just taking a meter reading with an external flash, an external meter, and shooting full manual mode. And of course, as well with manual, you can take a picture with digital now. You know, move it a couple of stops, take another image, move it a couple of stops. It's change your exposure. It's up to you. It's within the modern age. Just shoot and see what comes out. I wouldn't go for letting the camera automatically bracket it yourself, and then you've got complete control. I mean, the sun doesn't move that fast.
No, it doesn't. You've got at least 12 hours.
Yeah, but,
at least.
Well, no, because be fair, I mean, about 20 minutes perhaps, and then it's in a different
sunset,
location.
I guess, yeah. He's talking about sunsets. I'm just talking about the sun. It's funny you were talking about Photoshop. You were just mentioning there. It's going to bring us on to our last question. And it's actually from Ted Williams from Liverpool, so obviously not the famous dead baseball player. Last week, you guys said that when taking a picture, you could always then recover in Photoshop. I have a friend who is a pro photographer, and he says that shooting for Photoshop is lazy. I would hate to suggest that you fine gentlemen or anything of the sort, but what's your view on shooting to fix it later?
That's a tough question.
It's fun to be lazy sometimes.
Oh, no. I mean, there's a bit of me sitting here thinking, actually, I really am a bit of a lazy bastard. No, I'm going to justify myself here a little bit, perhaps. That's the only problem. No, I mean, I shoot stuff, and I've only got a finite time usually to be somewhere to take an image. I'm not taking an image for art. I'm taking an image for commercial purpose. And as a result, I want to gather as much as I can, as quickly as I can. And then, I can compensate for some of that when I get back. Now, that's not to say I just turn up, plonk a tripod down, just bandy a few shots off, and then think, well, there's something in there, perhaps. I want to get as close as I can to the finished article, but I'm more than well aware that to shoot the exact image that I want is probably never going to happen, and probably never has happened as well. We talked last week about every time you got back in the darkroom, you were adjusting for levels, or you were dodging or burning in places on the image. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I certainly didn't used to shoot for the darkroom, because that was too big an ask, and I wouldn't get to the stage now where I wanted to shoot to completely manipulate an image. I would expect fully when I get back into the darkroom to manipulate for levels, dodge, burn, the standard characteristic stuff that I always keep going on about that makes up 99% of me work in Photoshop. Occasionally, I'll steal an area from another image if I've got a better exposure or something like that, and that helps. I don't shoot for that, though. And certainly one of the things that's really useful, if you're shooting a group of people, you can never get all of the buggers to smile at the same time. So you take three or four there, and there's more than once I've taken someone else's picture smile of their face and stuck it onto a second photo of them. Because,
I could hear your teeth cringing right now admitting this.
No. I don't have a problem with it. I don't shoot for Photoshop, though. I'm just well aware of the fact that I have a limited period of time, and I can fix it if I need to. But I always want to get as close as I possibly can. And if you look at Alex's line, I mean, Alex would be the first to jump down my throat and say, you know, the he has to shoot as close as he possibly can. Because if you're talking about you've got a colour cast across a painting that clearly makes it nowhere near the colours it's supposed to be, that's a lot of work in Photoshop, and you still may never get it right. So the colour correction could be very, very askew. Alex would want to get as close as he possibly could before he then moved on, definitely. So I would say that we don't shoot for Photoshop. We're just well aware of the fact that with the briefness of time that we have, Photoshop is our aid rather than being our master. There we go.
Exactly. It complements what you do now. I mean, and it takes less time to do it. Well, I mean, seriously, it's a tool. We're talking about tools on the show. It's a tool.
Was that a good save or not?
Yeah, it's a hell of a save, man, and I'm trying to just let me help you.
No, I am a lazy bastard. There you go.
That's what it's there for. That's why we have Photoshop. That's why we spend $1,000 on it.
Yeah, no. I mean, like I said the other week, you know, I've got a copy of Photoshop 7 kicking around here somewhere, and I could live with that, you know, quite happily. If the earth stopped turning.
Until the OS changes and they can't use it anymore.
I don't know, actually, because it's Windows. It's that long ago. I've got CS2 for Mac. I might put that on and see if... But I think that works just fine. I mean, everyone came out, there was big issues over Snow Leopard and... there was big issues with Leopard and CS3. And then there was big issues with Snow Leopard and CS3. But I never had any of those. It worked just fine.
I think a lot of it's aimed more towards Windows, too, because... for some reason, it seems like compatibility with old software just—it's not as bad in Mac. Even I've experienced that. But you know, when the shift from XP to Vista, that's a nightmare for a lot of people. Which I think is one reason why it didn't do so well.
Yeah, the only thing that actually is the—I mean, I've got a copy of Windows 2000 here, and it's a fantastic operating system, and it ran Photoshop 7 beautifully. But I can't find a machine that that'll take the Windows 2000 disk. It just throws it out and spits it out. I tried running it in VM as well the other week, and it wouldn't even load up in VM. Truly obsolete.
Didn't know that you were even. He's still trying to.
I've got my coffee cup on it at the moment. That's about all it's useful for.
As you can see, we take your questions every week, guys, and we love to get them. We love to answer them, and you can easily send them to us. It's bageltechphoto@gmail.com, and usually we only get to about. Three, sometimes four, but usually about three a week. So we'd love to get yours on the show. And it's simple to do anything. I mean, you're talking tricks, you're talking how to, you know, possibly even use Photoshop or what is recommended by our pros that are on here. It's a little stripped down today. Like I said, Ewan is kindly, thank God you did, dude, because if it was just me, this would be a horrible podcast today.
Be a great audio photo show. No, I mean, send us some stuff through. In fact, actually, I think what we'll do in a couple of weeks is we might have a little Photoshop chit-chat about effects in Photoshop, that kind of stuff, because now the video's working a little bit better. We can actually do we can do screen captures and video capture of the computer while it's operating, so that might be quite nice.
That'd be a sweet idea, yeah. Of course, all of this is not possible without our sponsor, which is UK2.net, and, you know... I don't even want to think about where I would be renting right now because I sure couldn't stay in the house I'm in. Probably you too, Ewan.
they're pretty awesome.
Yeah, they're our lifeline. Yeah, they are. BagelTechNews.com is the destination. Go over there. You're going to see the little click through at the bottom and just click on that. If you're in the mood for looking some web hosting right now, give them a check out, you know, see if it's going to work for you. Like I said, we were never saying go and buy it, but at least use the click through so that way they know we are sending you so we can keep bringing you this show and all the shows on the Bagel Tech Network for free, because without them, no photo, no Bagel Tech Network, nothing. We would simply pack up and go away. So UK2.net, thank you very much for your support of the Bagel Tech Photo and all the shows on the Bagel Tech Network. So this is usually the time where I say, yo, where can we get a hold of everybody? So, Ewan.
Just me.
Where can we get a hold?
You can get me on Twitter at Ewan Rankin, and you can get me on Twitter at Bagel Tech News, which is where I post most of me turgid rubbish from. And also, you can have a look at my website, ewanrankin.co.uk, which I'm nearly finished revamping, which should look a lot more arty than it currently does when it finally comes around. And I'm going to pick up the Photoshop guys again, which I kind of let lapse because the lady in Russia that was doing them with me has moved on to Flash now, apparently. So we'll pick those up again.
I wonder why Flash, because we keep hearing Flash is dying. Of course, Google doesn't think so.
Apparently so.
I don't know. Oh, dude, it was a pleasure. Still, you know, it was unplugged today. As I said, it's the MTV Unplugged edition. We had our acoustic brushes out. For not reading, you've done very well.
I did okay. I was chuffed with that. Yeah, that'll do.
If you guys want to get hold of me, I'm also on Twitter at Kyle Swagger. You can follow me there and view my turdish rubbish, as you would say, Ewan.
Turgid. It's a different word.
Turgid.
Yeah.
Turgid. Not turgid. Okay.
Turdish
is that very British?
Yeah, it's very smelly.
Is turgid. It very British?
I suppose it's a very well-used phrase in Britain, but it's not... I don't know whether it's in the American dictionary or not. There's your homework for this week. Look up the word turgid.
Great. I'm going to do that. I'm going to go get the Webster's Dictionary out right now. I'm actually going to use a physical book.
You remember.
To see.
There we go.
Yeah. I know what it feels like. Guys, thanks for tuning in this week. We should have at least, maybe the whole gang will be back next week.
Should be.
Hopefully. Should be. We shall see. Join us next week for another installment of Bagel Tech Photo. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.